Hey, everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. And before we dive into today's story, make sure you're following the podcast on whatever platform you're using right now, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Audible, whatever it is, make sure you're following because that way you won't miss any future new episodes. And if you're interested in bonus content or ad-free episodes, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/mamamystery. We are back from CrimeCon, fresh on the heels of CrimeCon in Denver. It was so fun. This was my third time going to CrimeCon. And of course, Austin was with me. So if you're listening and you were also at CrimeCon, or if you're a new listener, you may have met Austin and myself. Sometimes Austin is on these episodes and we're working on getting him back on a regular basis. It's just kind of hard when we're both so busy. But all of that to say is that I loved going to CrimeCon. Our next CrimeCon is going to be in May in Vegas. So that is one that you will not want to miss. If you've ever debated going to CrimeCon, let me kind of give you a taste of what it's like. So it's usually a 2.5 day event, starting on Friday around noon, all day Saturday, ending Sunday around noon. The way that CrimeCon is set up is there are multiple stations, multiple big conference rooms that you can go into depending on what you're interested in, whether that's meeting some of your favorite creators or YouTube creators, podcast creators, or even just exhibitors like DNA, forensics, canines. I mean, literally anything to do with true crime is usually in that main podcast creator row is what it's called. And then there's other huge rooms where they have different panels going on. You can watch a live recording of a podcast. You can watch speakers like Nancy Grace, Matt Murphy, the hosts of Dateline, or even just families that you know that have been affected by true crime in some way. Colby Ryan, who was Lori Daybell's son, was there and he gave a speech. John Ramsey, JonBenet Ramsey's father, was also there. He's usually there and gives a speech. It's just endless. I met Gabby Petito's mom, Stacey Chapin, Ethan Chapin's mother, was also there working with Othram, which is a DNA forensics company that helped really solve the Idaho 4 case. But it's really wild because as you walk through the hallways of this conference center and you're walking around, I mean, there's so many people constantly, you know, moving and just moving about, but you run into people like Josh Mankiewicz from Dateline or Nancy Grace or Ashley Banfield from News Nation. You just like run into them and they are always so nice. Brian Enten, who is one of my favorite investigative journalists, and Nate Eaton were also there. So I got to speak with them for a little bit. I mean, it's just like such a surreal experience. If you're really into true crime, you would ultimately recognize at least somebody there. So all of that is to say, if you've ever thought about going, consider going. It's the last weekend in May, and it's going to be in Vegas this time. Now, with all of that out of the way, I want to talk about a story that has been recommended to me a few times, and you might recognize this name. We are talking about Trudy Appleby. Trudy's story begins on a warm August morning in 1996 when 11 18-year-old Trudy Appleby waved goodbye to her dad in Moline, Illinois. She had really big plans for the day, maybe a swim with some of her friends near the Mississippi River, but by nightfall, Trudy had vanished without a trace. The mystery of what happened to Trudy would haunt her family and the entire Quad Cities community for nearly three decades. And now, 29 years later, the case that once seemed impossible to solve is closer than ever to a resolution. So let's dive in. Trudy Leanne Appleby was, by all accounts, a bright and lively 11-year-old girl in the summer of 1996. Born in September of 1984, she was growing up in a quiet residential area of Moline, Illinois, a city in the Quad Cities region along the Mississippi River. Trudy lived with her father, Dennis Appleby, who worked hard to provide a good life for his daughter. Her mother isn't often mentioned in public reports, suggesting that maybe Trudy's day-to-day life really centered mainly around her dad and close family friends. Now, those who knew Trudy described her as friendly, adventurous, and very responsible. She loved swimming and outings on the river, pretty normal for a kid living near the water. And she was also looking forward to a family vacation for which she had diligently saved about $200 of her own money. And 11 years old, I mean, that's amazing. In fact, Trudy was so excited for that upcoming trip that she had actually stashed away new clothes and cash in her room. And this tidbit would later become a very important clue because whatever happened on the day she disappeared, it was not a planned escape or teenage rebellion or some sort of runaway. All her vacation money and new outfits were left behind in her room. Now, friends and family paint a picture of Trudy as an outgoing kid with a bit of a daring streak. She was the type to really stand up for herself. Trudy was no shrinking violet. She was known to be brave and outspoken for her age. If something or someone made her uncomfortable, she was not likely to just quietly comply. She would resist. She'd fight back. And this aspect of her personality, tragically, may have put her in danger if an adult tried to harm her, which we'll get to all of that. But Trudy was also deeply loved by those around her. She was an only child, the apple of her dad's eye, and a beloved niece to extended family. Her uncle Ray would later say that every year without answers felt like reopening a wound. Now, before we get into the day that everything changed, it's important to understand one more thing about Trudy's world, which was the people around her. The Appleby's Moline home was tucked away off of the main road, not even visible from the street. So this was not a place that random strangers would just stumble upon. The people who knew how to find Trudy's house were mostly friends and family. One of those neighbors or friends was a neighbor and close family friend named William or Ed Smith. And we'll hear a lot more about him later. But this guy often took Trudy out on his boat along with his grandchildren. Now, Trudy was especially close to one of Ed Smith's grandchildren and frequently joined their family outings on the Mississippi River. These were happy adventures for her. Dennis Appleby trusted Ed, his friend, to include Trudy in those fun summer activities. And this context makes what happened next all the more heartbreaking because the last people associated with Trudy's disappearance were not strangers at all, but people that she and her family knew well. With this picture of Trudy's life in mind, a vivacious 11-year-old who loved swimming and boating, saving her pennies for vacation and surrounded by a loving father and friends, we turn now to the day it all went wrong. So let's walk through the timeline of August 21st, 1996, the day Trudy Appleby vanished. So Wednesday, August 21st of 1996 started out as an ordinary summer day in the Appleby house. Trudy's father, Dennis, headed off to work around 9 a.m., leaving Trudy at home for the morning. It was the tail end of summer break right before Trudy would start sixth grade, so she likely had the day to herself or with her friends. Before Dennis left, Trudy had asked him a question. Could she go swimming with a friend on Campbell's Island that day? Now, Campbell's Island is a small residential island in the Mississippi River, just adjacent to East Moline, connected to the mainland by a bridge. It's a popular local spot for boating and swimming. However, Dennis said no. Perhaps he was uncomfortable with her going without adult supervision, or maybe he just wanted her to stay close to home. But he had no way of knowing that this simple refusal might prompt Trudy to make a risky choice. According to later police records, phone records from that morning suggest that Trudy made contact with someone about going to Campbell's Island despite her dad's veto. So in other words, she may have arranged a secret outing, which is typical kid logic. Dad said no, but maybe I can still go and have fun and be back before he even finds out. But tragically, if that is what happened, it was a decision that changed everything. Sometime between 9:30 and 10:30 a.m., a neighbor witnessed something unusual in the Applebee's driveway. Trudy was seen getting into the passenger side of an older model silver or gray four-door car, a boxy-style vehicle, similar to a Chevy Celebrity or Cavalier. I don't think they make celebrities anymore. But anyway, the driver was described as a white male in his 20s with curly dark hair down to his shoulders, wearing a baseball cap. The neighbor didn't recognize him, and this sighting was odd for a couple of reasons. First, the Applebee home was tucked away from the main road. Strangers would not normally know that anyone even lived back there. Second, Trudy leaving with someone while her dad was away was out of character unless it was a trusted family friend. It's very likely that in Trudy's mind, it was someone she trusted. That's why she willingly got in the car, beach towel and swimsuit in hand, ready for a day of swimming. The neighbor did not see any kind of struggle or hesitation. By all appearances, Trudy left voluntarily with this individual. Now, at the time, the neighbor could only provide a general description to police, an unknown young man in a gray car. The significance of that description would become clearer much later. But on that day in 1996, it was the first crucial clue. Trudy had not run away on foot. She left in a vehicle with someone. So that morning, another piece of the puzzle was reportedly observed elsewhere on Campbell's Island. In a twist that only came to light years later, a witness on Campbell's Island saw a car matching the same description near the home of William or Ed Smith, the Applebee family friend with the boat that I was telling you guys about earlier. Now, this witness saw this later in the morning and saw Trudy in that car. According to that witness, who was actually Ed Smith's son-in-law, David Whipple, Ed Smith was seen retrieving life jackets from his house and then leaving with Trudy in the car. This sighting on Campbell's Island would not be publicly revealed until much later, but I mention it here because it fits chronologically. Now, by late morning, Trudy was last seen alive on Campbell's Island in the company of Ed Smith. After that, she was never seen again. Neither Trudy nor the man driving that gray car ever returned to the Applebee home that day. Dennis Applebee came home from work that day, expecting to find Trudy, but she obviously was not there. Initially, one can imagine that he might have thought she was at a friend's house or maybe somewhere close by. But as time passed and Trudy failed to show up, Dennis's concern only mounted. By that evening, he reported his daughter missing to the Moline police. The investigation began under pretty ambiguous circumstances. At first, officers couldn't be sure if they were dealing with a runaway child or something more sinister. Trudy was an 11-year-old, after all, and sometimes young kids wander off. However, several red flags quickly pointed to an abduction rather than a simple runaway case. Once it was clear Trudy was missing under these circumstances, a full-scale search effort began. Moline police, likely joined by neighbors and volunteers, started combing through the area that night and in the days that followed. They canvassed the neighborhood, they asked anyone if they had seen or heard something from that morning. That's presumably how they solidified the timeline between 9:30 and 10:30 a.m. from the neighbor's sighting. Now, the Mississippi River and Campbell's Island are also natural places to check, given Trudy's request to go swimming there. Early on, though, law enforcement hadn't publicly identified any specific suspect. They likely did speak to known friends of the family, including Ed Smith, in those first hours and days. And according to later accounts, Ed denied knowing anything when he was questioned and gave no admission that he had seen Trudy that day. In fact, police said Ed never admitted any knowledge of Trudy's disappearance at all, even years later. Give me a break. Still, behind the scenes, some suspicion was already gravitating toward Ed Smith almost immediately. Now remember, he was a friend of Trudy's father and often took Trudy boating. So if Trudy had wanted to sneak off swimming, Ed's place on Campbell's Island would be a logical destination for her. Additionally, the witness David Whipple, who is Ed's son-in-law, allegedly did tell a few what he saw that day. That Ed left with Trudy, but that Ed reportedly threatened to kill this witness if he went to police. Now, whether that threat was known to detectives in 1996 or only divulged later is unclear. But what we do know is that Ed did something very suspicious within a week of Trudy's disappearance, which was he got rid of his car. The same gray sedan that multiple witnesses placed Trudy in was suddenly scrapped for junk just 4 days after she vanished. Police later confirmed that Ed Smith indeed had his car destroyed within a week of August 21st, 1996. And if that isn't a red flag, I don't know what is. But at the time in 96, that fact might not have immediately been discovered or publicized. As the first weeks went by, no trace of Trudy was found. There were no 911 calls from a distressed child, no body recovered from the river, nothing. This case was already slipping into the dreaded category of an unsolved mystery in the making, but the community was galvanized. Friends printed missing persons flyers, and the local media ran Trudy's story on the news consistently. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children even created age-progressed images in the later years showing what Trudy might look like as an adult, and those were circulated in hopes of generating some fresh leads. For the Appleby family, every day without answers was torture. Still, they refused to give up. Dennis Appleby appeared on the news pleading for anyone with knowledge to come forward, saying, quote, "These are the people I named as the ones who I felt were responsible. The only thing that kept this thing going for so long is we don't have Trudy's body," end quote. And he was expressing his frustration that lack of physical evidence made it hard to bring charges, even though he had names in mind. In those early days, though, he could only hope the police would find something concrete. Meanwhile, the neighbor's description of the unknown man in the ball cap and the gray car was essentially the only lead publicly shared. Police likely kept any suspicions about Ed Smith or others under wraps until they could get more proof. Unfortunately, substantial proof was really hard to come by. As weeks turned into months and then years, the case went cold, but it was never closed. Investigators periodically revisited the file, especially around anniversaries, and Trudy's family kept her story alive in the press. Over the late 90s and early 2000s, Trudy's case became one of the Quad Cities' most haunting cold cases. Year after year, Dennis Appleby and other family members kept pushing for answers. They organized a candlelight vigil every August 21st, a solemn gathering where friends, neighbors, and police would stand together, remember Trudy, and renew pleas for new information. There were occasional reported sightings of girls who might be Trudy, as happens in many missing child cases. We actually just saw this happen with Emmanuel Harrow that I've talked about multiple times in the weekly docket, but there were apparently some sightings of Emmanuel, and it ended up leading to nothing. Same with Trudy's case, but at least people were still keeping an eye out and people still knew their names, right? And I mean, that's really all you can hope for when it comes to getting the public to help in some way. But investigators also kept a close eye on the people around Trudy's life. It was clear early on that the key to solving this mystery lay not with a random kidnapper, but with individuals close to home. As I mentioned, from the very beginning, Ed Smith stood out as a person of interest behind closed doors. Here was a man who was a friend of Trudy's father, practically part of the extended family, who owned a boat, lived on Campbell's Island, and was allegedly last seen with Trudy. When police spoke to Ed in 1996, he denied any involvement and claimed he didn't know what happened. However, investigators noticed some troubling signs. Ed's demeanor raised eyebrows. He appeared despondent whenever Trudy's name came up in conversation with him. Detectives found his emotional reactions off-putting, almost as if he knew something terrible. And then there was Ed's car. His vehicle matched the description of the one that took Trudy, and records showed that he had it scrapped within days of her going missing. Now, who destroys their car right after a child last seen in it disappears? That obviously looks highly suspicious. But there was no body, no crime scene, and Ed stuck to his story of knowing nothing. Without physical evidence or an eyewitness willing to testify, the police in the 90s were stuck. They believed Ed Smith was involved. Perhaps he took Trudy out on the river and something bad happened, but belief isn't proof. In fact, Dennis Appleby himself shared a theory that he suspected that Ed Smith and maybe others took Trudy on a boat ride that day and maybe an accident happened. In fact, Dennis openly speculated that maybe Ed tried to do something inappropriate. He actually said that maybe he tried to, quote, do something funny, end quote, as he delicately phrased it. And maybe Trudy resisted, resulting in her getting hurt or worse. And we know that this is part of Trudy's personality, that she was a fighter. She would fight for things that were wrong, and she would stand up for herself if she was in a compromising position. It was a painful scenario for a father to imagine, but it fit what little they knew. If Trudy had drowned or been killed accidentally, maybe Ed panicked and hid her body. That was Dennis's personal theory for many years, and it's worth noting, Dennis did not initially want to believe any of his friends intentionally murdered his daughter. He leaned toward the idea of a cover-up of a tragic accident, and given Ed's seemingly distraught behavior and refusal to talk, that theory felt plausible to Trudy's family. Through the 2000s, Ed Smith remained quietly under the investigative microscope. Police would periodically re-interview him or people around him, hoping someone would crack. One of those people was David Whipple, Ed's son-in-law, who lived across the street from Ed in 1996. Now, Whipple was actually the key witness who had seen Trudy in Ed's car on Campbell's Island that morning. But Whipple wasn't exactly a cooperative witness. In fact, he was deeply enmeshed in this murky situation. He later became considered a second person of interest, actually, and we'll get to that story in a moment. But the big picture is that both Ed Smith and David Whipple stayed very tight-lipped for a very long time. Now imagine being a detective on this case in the early 2000s. You strongly suspect someone who was responsible, but you can't prove it. You have a missing child presumed dead. You have circumstantial clues pointing to a family friend, but no forensic evidence, no body or remains that could tell the tale. And one of your eyewitnesses, Whipple, isn't testifying, possibly because he's implicated or afraid. This is a nightmare scenario, not just for the parents, but for law enforcement. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out for more new to you styles. I will admit I was a little skeptical at first because I'm not the type of person who dresses up very often, but you guys, this is actually so perfect and I'm genuinely so excited about this new membership with Armoire. And I want to tell you what the process was like for me. I got onto their website and I mean, there were so much to choose from. I ended up choosing 6 items and I was kind of like, we'll see what happens, you know, not sure how they were going to arrive, if they were going to be like noticeably used or what. But listen, 2 days after I placed my like case order, it showed up on my doorstep. Everything was like, when I pulled it out of the bag, everything was neatly folded and then tied up in this really pretty little bow. And I got so excited. I'm actually taking a trip to Dallas with my daughter soon, so I'm gonna wear an outfit for that. Austin and I are gonna go to a Teddy Swims concert, so I got an outfit for that. I'm like, you guys, I'm so excited about this because everything showed up in great condition. I mean, I think it looks brand new. And it's $900 worth of clothes that I'm renting for less than $100. And the best part for me is that I can just send it back. I don't typically dress up that often, but this is so perfect for like the random occasions that I do dress up without having to go and like splurge on an entire new outfit that I might only wear once. I will be honest, I feel guilty that over half of my closet has only been worn once, if at all. And there are even a few items that are going to Goodwill with the tags on them. So I love being on trend and having new things to wear, but I hate the waste that I'm creating when I do that, right? So Armoire allows me to rent these high quality designer clothes for any occasion and then just send it back. If you've got a wedding or a job interview or just like anything that you just want to kind of dress up a little bit. But the nice thing is they also have athleisure. So I got this really cute Kate Spade anorak jacket that I can wear with like a pair of leggings, and it just kind of makes you feel a little more dressed up while you're still dressed down. I also got some really cool floral wide leg pants from Steve Madden with this really cute denim halter like front vest top to go with it. And just in case that doesn't work out, I got another option too to go with the pants, and then I can have like kind of two outfits in one. You guys, I cannot tell you enough how excited I am about this. And right now my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Please try Armoire today, and if you do, tag me in the pictures of your outfits so I can get some inspiration and kind of see what y'all are getting. But this is so fun. I'm really, really excited about this. Thanks again to Armoire for sponsoring today's episode. And now back to the story.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
By law, they needed something concrete to make an arrest or get charges filed. So as the years passed, many feared that justice would never come. By August of 2014, sadly, William Ed Smith passed away at the age of 72, taking whatever secrets he had to the grave. For Trudy's family, Ed's death was a bitter development. They feared the prime suspect had escaped earthly justice entirely. But investigators saw an opportunity in a sense, because with Ed gone, maybe others would be more willing to talk, no longer fearing him or his retribution. Indeed, it was after Ed Smith's death that the case saw its first big public breakthrough. On the 21st anniversary of Trudy's disappearance in August of 2017, the Moline Police Department made a bold move. They held a press conference and for the first time publicly named Ed Smith as the prime suspect in the case. This was a watershed moment. Until then, police had never officially pointed the finger at anyone in the media, but now they openly said that Ed Smith, who had died in 2014, was believed to be the man responsible for whatever happened to Trudy. Detective Michael Griffin revealed some of the evidence that had long been kept under wraps. He stated that a witness saw Trudy in Ed's car on Campbell's Island on the morning of August 21st, 1996. Griffin detailed how the witness observed Ed Smith loading life jackets into the vehicle and then driving away with Trudy in tow. He also mentioned Ed's ominous threat to that witness, essentially confirming that Ed had tried to silence the one person who could place him with Trudy. By going public, the police were putting a lot of cards on the table, and the reason? Likely they hoped to jolt new witnesses or tipsters into coming forward. Perhaps someone who had been on the fence about sharing information or who had dismissed Ed's involvement as just a theory would realize, wow, the police are sure Ed did it. Maybe I should tell them what I know. Also, since Ed was deceased, there was no risk of defamation or ruining a living person's reputation, so they could speak more freely about the suspicion. So if you, like me, were wondering why they waited until after he died to announce these things, well, that is why. Now, at that 2017 presser, Trudy's father, Dennis, also spoke, giving an emotional interview to local station WQAD. Dennis candidly laid out his belief that Ed Smith was the last person to see his daughter alive. This public identification of Ed Smith was a turning point psychologically. It validated what the Appleby family had believed for years and signaled that the case was active again, not forgotten. The press conference also had another effect. It put pressure on David Whipple, the son-in-law witness. In 2017, Whipple was still alive, and he'd be around 56 at that time. By naming Ed, the police indirectly shone a spotlight on Whipple, too, since it was well known in certain circles that he was the witness in question. The clear subtext was, "We know you saw something, and now the world knows it, too." And they were possibly hoping Whipple might finally cooperate if he felt less afraid of Ed's old threat or more public accountability. After 2017, the investigation gained even more momentum. Tips did come in, some perhaps spurred by the publicity, and detectives kept digging, literally and figuratively. Notably, they even seized Ed Smith's boat at some point, hoping to find forensic evidence on it. Now, unfortunately, if anything was found, it has not been disclosed publicly. They also continued to track the movements and actions of anyone connected to Ed who might have been involved. This is where another figure enters the story, Jameson or Jamie Fisher. Now, Jamie was a lifelong friend of the Smith family. Think of him almost as an extended family member or close family friend who grew up around Ed's children and grandchildren. In 1996, Jamie was about 22 years old, right in the age range of that mysterious curly-haired driver described by the neighbor. In fact, he perfectly matched that description. Early 20s, long curly hair, baseball cap. Jamie was one of those people still alive who knew what happened, at least in the police's eyes. But for many years, he stayed under the radar publicly, and that all changed in 2020. In August of 2020, 24 years after Trudy went missing, Moline police made another announcement. They officially named two additional persons of interest in Trudy's case, and those individuals were David Whipple and Jamie Fisher. Now, David, by then around 60 years old, was labeled POI number 2, and Fisher, who was then 45, was POI number 3. This was huge news because it confirmed that the investigation extended beyond just Ed acting alone. The implication was that these men may have helped cover up whatever caused her disappearance. In other words, police suspected that David and Jamie either knew or assisted in whatever happened to Trudy. And now with Ed gone, the focus was now squarely on these two surviving persons of interest. The case was heating up, albeit quietly. Police still needed solid evidence to move beyond just persons of interest to actual charges, and they were working on it. From 2020 onward, it seems investigators intensified their efforts. They re-interviewed old witnesses, followed up on new tips, and even conducted new searches for Trudy's remains or any evidence. And one such search took place in 2023, indicating that the net was closing in. In August of 2023, just weeks before the 27th anniversary of Trudy's disappearance, Moline police executed a surprise search warrant on a private property in Kelowna, Illinois. Kelowna is a small town in Henry County, not far from the Quad Cities. The search was specifically connected to the Trudy Appleby case, a remarkable development after so many years. Investigators swarmed a residence on the 600 block of 8th Street in Kelowna, digging in the yard and looking for any evidence of Trudy. They had quite the task force out there. They had East Moline Police, Kelowna Police, Illinois State Police, including crime scene units, FBI, and the Henry County State Attorney's Office, all involved. So clearly, this was a big deal. Investigators had followed every lead over the years and were leaving no stone unturned, as Moline PD put it during that search. But the Kelowna search was one of those stones. And why Kelowna? The authorities didn't publicly say whose property it was, but given that Henry County later became the jurisdiction for charges, one might guess it had some link to Jamie Fisher or his associates. It's possible that Jamie lived in or had ties to Kelowna. The police never announced finding human remains there, and subsequent reports indicated that the search came up empty, at least in terms of finding Trudy. It must have been another blow to the family, another buildup of hope, then no concrete answers. Still, the Kelowna operation signaled that police believed they were getting close. And there's a telling quote from Detective Michael Griffin in 2024 after that search. On the 28th anniversary vigil in August of 2024, Detective Griffin stood before the crowd and delivered a pointed message aimed at whoever was responsible, saying, quote, "The people that are involved, that are alive, they know we're coming. We're not giving up, and this isn't going away," end quote. Now, that statement was both ominous and reassuring. Ominous for the culprits, of course, and reassuring for the community that they're not giving up. And indeed, the Moline police and the Appleby family were letting it be known that even after nearly three decades, they are not giving up and they would get justice for Trudy. And they did. The pieces were all about to fall into place. The long unfinished puzzle, as Chief Gault called it, was finally nearing completion. On August 14th of this year, just 1 week shy of the 29th anniversary of Trudy Appleby's disappearance, a bombshell announcement was made. Jameson A., or Jamie Fisher, 50 years old, was indicted for the murder of Trudy Appleby. This development marked the first time anyone had ever been formally charged in connection with Trudy's case. For the Appleby family, it was a moment of mixed emotions, a turning point in this mystery, as Chief Gault said, though certainly not a happy occasion given the loss behind it. The indictment came from a Henry County grand jury, meaning prosecutors had presented evidence behind closed doors to jurors who agreed that there was enough to formally accuse Jamie of the crime. The charges were steep: three counts of first-degree murder and one count of concealment of a homicidal death. Essentially, they are alleging that Jamie not only killed Trudy, but also took actions to hide her body. Officials clarified one odd detail. Due to the statute of limitations, they could not charge Fisher with kidnapping since too much time had passed for that specific charge under Illinois law, which that should be changed. However, murder has no statute of limitations, and concealment of a homicidal death is a charge that can still be brought as well. So the indictment even specifies how Jamie allegedly killed Trudy: by strangulation. That harrowing detail, that an 11-year-old girl was strangled, had never been publicly confirmed until the indictment. And it's a chilling confirmation on what investigators long suspected, which was foul play in Trudy's death. Now, you might wonder why Henry County? Trudy disappeared from her home in Moline, which was Rock Island County. But prosecutors chose Henry County for the case because, as they revealed, the alleged location of the homicide is within Henry County. So this suggests that authorities believe Trudy was killed not in Moline or on Campbell's Island, but perhaps across the river or somewhere under Henry County jurisdiction. Kelowna, for instance, is in Henry County. So it's possible that through phone records, witness accounts, or even evidence gathered in that 2023 search, they were able to pinpoint a likely site of the crime. In any event, Henry County State's Attorney Catherine Runty is leading the prosecution with assistance from Rock Island County's State's Attorney and other agencies. So this is a team effort by Illinois prosecutors to finally bring justice. Chief Darren Galt and State Attorney Runty held a press conference to announce the indictment. Now, Chief Galt's words carried the weight of years of effort. He said, quote, "This development is the result of tireless work by generations of investigators, unwavering support from our community, and pieces of new information that helped us complete a long unfinished puzzle. We never gave up." And he added, "Today is not about celebration. It's about resolution. It's about accountability. And most importantly, it's about Trudy Appleby. This arrest does not erase the pain, but it does bring us one step closer to closure." And those words really struck a chord because this wasn't some victory lap, but rather a solemn acknowledgement of progress in a tragedy. At the same press conference, State's Attorney Runty emphasized that Jamie is accused of strangling Trudy and concealing her death. She noted that although they cannot charge kidnapping, the focus is on holding the murderer accountable. A poignant moment came when Rock Island County's State's Attorney Dora Villarreal, who helped in the case, said, quote, "This is what 29 years of sweat, tears, and all-consuming dedication looks like, waiting for that final decision." And indeed, it took 29 years of persistence to finally get that indictment. It's important to clarify that an indictment is not a conviction. Jamie will still need to face a trial, and he maintains the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. As of the latest updates, as of just last month, actually, Jamie was being held in custody, waiting arraignment and trial. Interestingly, Jamie was already in jail in Scott County, Iowa, on unrelated charges when the indictment came down. Specifically, he had been jailed for a probation violation related to a drug case in Iowa. Once the Illinois charges were filed, an Iowa judge quickly moved to modify his custody status so that he could be extradited to Illinois to face those murder charges. Kelly Cunningham, the Scott County, Iowa attorney, explained that she cooperated with Illinois authorities to ensure that Jamie would be transferred to Henry County promptly for trial on Trudy's case. So essentially, they didn't want the Iowa drug case to delay any justice for Trudy. Illinois gets to go first, it takes precedence. Now, Jamie's background played a role in how they finally nabbed him. Remember that he had been named a person of interest in 2020 and then got into legal trouble for auto theft, serving prison time in 2021. In 2023 and 2024, he was dealing with drug charges and probation issues. It seems the police and prosecutors used the opportunity of him being incarcerated to assemble their case. They possibly confronted him or those around him with some of this new evidence. We do know that the indictment itself is sealed, so the specific evidence that convinced the grand jury hasn't been made public yet. However, the circumstantial pieces that we've discussed, like witness statements, possible forensic evidence from Ed's boat or elsewhere, maybe admissions by someone, or maybe something that was found on that Kelowna property, all likely contributed. Now, if you're wondering, why just Jamie? Why not David? Well, David Whipple sadly died in August of 2022 at age 61 without ever having cooperated with police. Neither Ed nor David ever faced justice in their lifetimes. I'm sure they're probably facing it now. It's probably really warm where they are, but both took whatever they knew to their graves. That leaves Fisher as the only living suspect in the case. And now all eyes are on him. He has always denied his involvement in Trudy's disappearance. Even after his indictment, there's been no public confession or anything of that sort. It appears he will contest the charges at trial, and the legal process will move forward with Jamie presumably pleading not guilty and maybe mounting a defense. But one interesting fact is that Jamie's indictment came as he was nearing the end of this unrelated prison term, and he was initially set to be released in 2026 from the auto theft sentence. So now, instead of walking free, he's facing a murder trial. So we love that for him. But for the Appleby family, the indictment was a long-awaited step. They know it's not the end. A conviction and, more importantly, finding Trudy's body are still the ultimate goals. But it was significant validation that law enforcement heard them and kept at it. At a vigil held on the very anniversary, August 21st, 2025, there was a different energy. People wore blue and white Nike shoes in Trudy's honor, the same kind of shoes she was wearing when she disappeared. Detective Griffin shared that little tribute, noting that the department donned those Nike sneakers as a silent nod to Trudy's memory. Throughout this nearly three-decade saga, the community in and around Moline never forgot Trudy Appleby. Her case became probably the most well-known missing person case in the Quad Cities area. Every year on August 21st, local news would run segments reminding people of the little girl who vanished in 1996, often accompanied by an age-progressed image or a short interview with her family. And this consistent exposure kept pressure on the investigative agencies and also kept potential witnesses thinking. For instance, someone who may have been afraid to speak in the 90s might feel differently 20 years later when seeing a vigil on TV, thinking, you know, maybe now I should tell what I know. As of now, Trudy's body still has not been found. It remains an open plea from law enforcement and her family that if anyone out there knows where Trudy's remains were placed, please speak up. Having a grave or a place to properly lay her head to rest would mean the world to her loved ones. There is also the grim possibility that her body may never be recovered, something that happens in a number of no-body homicide cases. In fact, prosecutors noted that Trudy's is one of 605 cases nationwide being prosecuted without a recovered body. It's challenging, but not impossible, to secure a conviction in such cases, and clearly Illinois authorities are competent enough in their evidence to proceed. Now, one silver lining in this long, dark cloud is how the community really rallied and how investigators across generations stuck with it. Cold cases only get solved when someone cares enough to keep digging. Here, we saw Detective Griffin and Chief Galt and many others take up the mantle years after the original 1996 detectives retired. And of course, the voice of Trudy's family, especially her father Dennis and her uncle Ray, kept reminding everyone on the human face behind the case. Cases like this, where justice is brought, even if it is decades later, gives me hope for so many of the families that I met this weekend at CrimeCon. I met a few families who have missing loved ones or loved ones who passed under circumstances that were very suspicious, and yet the death was ruled a suicide or something that just does not make sense. And so when I hear about a closure in a case like this or impending closure, it just gives me renewed hope for these families, and I hope that they find that hope too. And I really think that, you know, gatherings or conventions like CrimeCon really restore your faith in humanity, because you are among people that are so passionate about justice for families. And you'll never meet a more dedicated, driven, and compassionate group of people than you will at CrimeCon or those who are into true crime. So with that being said, it is why I always say at the end of every episode, stay curious and stay vigilant, because you never know whose case you might be able to solve. With that being said, have a great week.
Mama, mystery out.
Bye.
Everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.